You're listening to Uncommentary, the home of conversations and clarity. I'm your host, Marty Duran. Well, hey, everybody. This is Marty. It has been a minute since we have been on an Uncommentary episode, and I have missed it tremendously, and I've heard some good stuff from y'all that y'all missed it too. But I'm really glad to be back with the guest that I have today. I've been aware of Tim Alberta for some time. He's been a well-known columnist now with The Atlantic, I think. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
But you've written for a lot of others. And so I've seen your name bandied about at times with different articles. And I will say, and this is about as high a praise as I can get, I'm about halfway through your Detroit Lions article. And it's Tom Junod-esque, if I'm sure you know Tom Junod. So two of my favorite long-form articles ever are The Falling Man from 9/11 and Can You Say Hero, his profile of Mr. Rogers. And so for me to say to you that you're in that territory is about as high a praise as I can give a
I'll take it, man. Journalist. I will take it. That's good stuff.
So I've been following you on Twitter for a while, and I think you followed me back at some point, so I'm grateful for that. And I became aware of your latest book. So you had written a book right after or into Trump's administration, I guess, called American Carnage. And before we get into your new book, just kind of summarize what burdened you. You are a believer, a follower of Jesus, and this comes through in your writing pretty clearly. And I'm going to get into some of that as we go along. But what kind of burdened you to write American Carnage?
Well, I think as much as anything, it was wanting to compile into one place an account of the why of Donald Trump. Not the blow by blow inside his White House, not the, you know, the leaking and the gossiping and the palace intrigue, but really to understand as a historical matter how the party of Ronald Reagan and you know, George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, how it fell apart so quickly and how it was essentially hijacked and taken over by Trump, and what that reflected about what was happening in American culture and, you know, American religion, and to really try and synthesize all of that in one place. Because I wanted to make sure I'd been covering the right for, you know, 10 or 12 years by the time Trump had been elected. And so I had about as close a front row seat as anybody did to really understanding the collapse of the party and the rise of this sort of new populist wing that Trump became kind of the embodiment of. And so, putting that together was important to me. Just because I felt like people were going to try to be making sense of it for like the next 50 years.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely. Absolutely. So then you moved on from, and that was the title, that wasn't the title he gave to his speech, I guess, his inauguration speech, but American Carnage was the title that it came to be associated with.
Yes.
And so then you moved on to a different line of thinking. And so I want to kind of lay a groundwork for what your book is like for those who haven't read it. I've talked to a lot of evangelicals on my podcast along the way, and a lot of the criticisms that people like Kristen Dumais or someone in her view of American evangelicalism kind of get slammed because their books are not theological. They're historical or they're sociological or stuff like that. And you can go through any number of them, and there's just not a lot of scripture references. There's not a lot of, this is, you know, what Jesus taught, other than feed the poor and clothe the hungry, or feed the hungry and clothe the poor. And that's about the limit that a lot of it goes to. But in getting into your book, there's a couple of things that I noticed. First, whoever made the decision not to name the chapters, I thought that was a really smart move. It's less distracting. You go to the table of contents, it's just the list, chapter one and a page number, chapter two and a page number. So there's no like getting into it without getting into it. You have to get into the book to get into the book. But the second thing is virtually every chapter, unless I'm mistaken, every chapter so far, and I'm about 320 pages in, You do your own theological analysis of what is taking place. And I think that really does set your book apart from a lot of the evaluations of evangelicalism. So I want to ask you this question. Why was it important for you to take that specific approach rather than just doing journalism? Why did you decide to remark theologically and biblically about so much of the content that you were unearthing through these interviews?
I think the short answer to that, Marty, is that the only cure for bad theology is good theology, mm-hmm. right? And I think we are dealing with, in the church today, not just bad theology, but distorted theology, mm-hmm. or theology that is, infusing extra biblical stuff into it. You know, mm-hmm. You have this sort of conflation of politics and theology, culture war and theology, kind of tribal thinking and theology. And so it was important for me to just sort of go back to the source and say, well, hold on a second. If we're going to talk about any of these issues, and specifically, if we're going to talk not about the who, you know, who do you vote for, mm-hmm. or the what policies do you support, but the how mm-hmm. are Christians called to engage with the world, with each other, with civics, with politics, with you know, all of it, then let's go to the source and let's really analyze clearly what Scripture tells us. And what we find when we do that is a really unambiguous message of mm-hmm. of grace and love and accountability mm-hmm. For our actions. And, you know, it would be so much easier if at any point Jesus, or for that matter, Peter or Paul, had instructed us, hey, when someone mistreats you, then you've got permission to mistreat them back.
Take no prisoners.
Ultimately, you're trying to spread the gospel here, and so the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be. I find myself at times wishing that that was the case, because wouldn't it make things simpler? But that's not what we're told, and it feels to me as though part of the crisis of American Christianity is simply a lack of sound Christian doctrine being preached in a lot of these churches, and frankly, even taking it a step further, not even just not being preached, but it feels as though in today's environment, I can't tell you how many pastors I've had this identical conversation with. You know, they get their congregants for an hour and 15 minutes on a Sunday morning.
Yep.
And then the rest of the week, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, they are inundated, you know, podcasts, talk radio, mm-hmm. social media, cable news. They are inundated with rhetoric and with analysis and with instruction that oftentimes runs directly counter to what they hear on Sunday mornings. Yep. And so the proportionality is just so far out of whack that it feels as though if we're going to start getting our arms around this problem, the place to start is in Scripture.
And American Christians seem to have an enormous capacity for squeezing the Sunday morning sermon into what they already think without it creating any kind of cognitive dissonance. And so the pastor can say exactly the opposite of what they've heard in media all week long, and they come away thinking that he's reinforced it because they just squeeze it into that mold, and they don't allow the rough edges to be chipped off or the negative stuff to be knocked out. So the name of your new book then is The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. How did you choose the people that you were going to interview for this book?
Boy, oh boy.
Just sat on Twitter and took notes.
Right. Actually, in some cases, yes, that's true. You know, what I really set out to do was just cast the widest net possible. And I wanted to make sure. Now, I say early in the book that this is not a project aimed at reporting on the whole of Christianity mm-hmm. in this country.
Right.
I did not. By design, I did not spend time in the Catholic Church. I did not spend time in the Black Church. I did not spend time in the Progressive Church or the Mainline Church, for that matter. I really wanted this project to focus on, you know, conservative white evangelicalism, mm-hmm. in part because that's my tribe. That's, mm-hmm. you know, where I come from. And we can talk more about my story. But really, also, it's a matter of understanding the kind of foundational shifts happening in American Christianity and in American politics to a large extent are traced back to that white evangelical tradition. So even in casting that net, you come to appreciate just what a spectrum there is mm-hmm. in the evangelical community, which is to say that, you know, you have your Greg Locke's and your Robert Jeffress's and your Eric Metaxas's and your Charlie Kirk's kind of over here at one side. And then you've got people who I think, again, sort of theologically and doctrinally are in a very similar place to those guys, mm-hmm. but politically, culturally, attitudinally, they're at the complete opposite end of the spectrum. And then in the middle, you've got just, you know, tens of millions of people floating around sort of wondering where they belong.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in some cases kind of migrating back and forth between those two poles. So what I really tried to do was I spent, you know, over 3 years just basically traveling nonstop, you know, as you'll see in the book, like I'm just every corner of the country, every mm-hmm. region, every, you know, big churches, tiny churches in between. I really, at the end, the biggest challenge was figuring out who to leave out because wow. there were a lot of amazing experiences I had and a lot of fascinating people, fascinating stories, fascinating churches that ultimately just I had to cut out. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was going to be, you know, an 800-page book. But I tried to kind of capture some good representation of where these different where the fault lines are mm-hmm. and who represents what.
So you mentioned your story. Tell us how your personal history plays into your interest in this subject matter.
Yeah. So I'm a PK. My dad was an evangelical pastor. I say was because he's with the Lord now. He died 4 years ago. In fact, he died right after my first book came out. And that was the last time I got to see him, actually. He wow. and my mom drove out to Washington, D.C. from my childhood home in Michigan. They drove out to D.C. for the book party, and that was a big deal to have them there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was funny because my dad and I had a great relationship, but he was always kind of needling me about political journalism. Uh-huh. And he was always like, you know, do you really want to waste your whole life like chasing these idiots around? Like, you know, like
yeah,
God gave
yeah,
you these.
Yeah, yeah.
right, yeah. It's, you know. And it's, you know, it was raising a fair point, right? You know, God gave you these talents and, you know, you should think about how else you might glorify him and mm-hmm. what are the stories you could tell outside of just this political mess. Mm-hmm. And so that was actually one of the very last conversations we had. And then he died very abruptly thereafter, unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is that, you know, I had always been one of these, you know, evangelicals who sort of was reflexively defensive, quite defensive of my tribe. You know, when I would, especially working in the mainstream media, you know, mm-hmm. you're constantly exposed to a lot of caricaturing and marginalizing, and you're thinking, well, hold on a second, you don't know these people like I do. But there was some cognitive dissonance because at the same time, I'm seeing it. I've seen it my whole life, but particularly as I'm getting older, I'm seeing the corruption. I'm seeing the duplicity. Mm-hmm. And it's really deeply burdensome to me. But I hadn't gotten to a place where really I was willing to speak out about it. Mm-hmm. So then my dad dies. And you know, the short version of what unfolds thereafter is that, you know, at his funeral, at my home church, where he'd been the pastor for 26 years, and it was my whole life, was my whole community was wrapped mm-hmm. up in this church. I had people basically confronting me and wanting to argue about politics, wanting to argue about my book, wanting to argue about
the
Trump.
Head of the casket, right? While you were standing in the receiving
line. I mean, he's in a box like 100 feet away. And, you know, and people who I'd known my whole life, like, you know, they've known me since I was 5 years old. And they're like in my face wanting to argue about Donald Trump at my dad's viewing.
Wow.
And it was just one of these moments. And I think we all have them to some degree where something that was abstractly a problem suddenly becomes very concrete and almost mm-hmm. becomes urgent. And you think, oh, wow, I have to do something about this. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that was a moment where I'm just looking around thinking, oh, wow, this is worse than I thought. Like way worse than I thought. Right. Yeah. And not to say that the scale of it necessarily, like, because to be clear, these are a handful of people who had just really lost the plot and who mm-hmm. were, you know, who had their priorities so badly mixed up. But you know, that they're not a majority. They're not even close to a majority. But as in American politics, that fringe had become louder. Mm-hmm. It had become more organized, more influential. And they were really pushing on the mainstream in ways that were really producing a lot of strain inside my home church mm-hmm. and inside the movement at large. And so it was really that episode around my dad's death that prompted me to pursue this project.
One of the things that I appreciated early on is your, and I'm not going to remember any of these names because I didn't take good notes. I underlined like every other sentence in the book, but I didn't take any notes I can refer back to. The Australian theologian that you talked to at Wheaton.
Yeah, John Dixon.
Yes, made a really, I think I might have known this, but it really hit home. And that's the difference between the American version of evangelicalism and other evangelical expressions around the world. And in his mind, it was specifically Aussie and in Great Britain. Talk a little bit about why it's important for American evangelicals to understand that what we experience is not the global expression of evangelicalism.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it's I really try to unpack this carefully in the first section of the book, which is the kingdom. And the idea of the kingdom is, you know, we as Christians are called to belong to a kingdom that is not of this world, mm-hmm. right? Jesus talks repeatedly. I mean, it's one of the most frequent subjects of which Jesus speaks throughout the Gospels is about this kingdom of heaven or this mm-hmm. kingdom of God, telling us that we have a place there if we believe mm-hmm. in him. And he talks about it not as some kind of abstraction. He talks about it as a real place, a community of people, a nation, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that kingdom is where we have our citizenship as believers, right? And every other allegiance is meant to be secondary. And so what I try to write about in that first section of the book, the kingdom, is how the American kingdom has become in many ways a real rival to that kingdom mm-hmm. of heaven, at least in the minds of believers here. And I think so much of that American idolatry, if you will, is wrapped up in this notion of being a nation consecrated in the eyes of God, uniquely blessed, almost in covenant with God in mm-hmm. ways that, you know, Israel was in the Old Testament. And you know, as the pastor at my home church who succeeded my father, he explains in chapter one, he says, look, once you get to that point where you believe that like we're almost in covenant with God and that mm-hmm. when you're fighting for America, you are actually fighting for God. Mm-hmm. Like that is a really treacherous path that you're headed down. And what's so different about the evangelical tradition in Great Britain, in Australia, in Africa, in Asia, it is completely detached from national identity.
Yeah.
In fact, or even to the degree that it might be somehow tied to national identity, there's a very clear and rigid ordering. In other words, if you are in Australia, you view your Australian identity through the prism of your Christian identity, mm-hmm. right? Your national identity you view through the prism of your faith identity. In America, for a lot of reasons, some of which I touched on just now, we view our Christian identity through the prism of our American identity, mm-hmm. right? And that inversion of priorities is, it might not seem like it's hugely problematic on the surface, but when you start to unpack what's happened in the church in recent years, you can see why this is such a danger and why it's so thoroughly abiblical. And quite frankly, you can see why, again, throughout the Gospels, but also in the Old Testament as well, we are repeatedly warned to not be invested in the idea of national citizenship, right. Why we are repeatedly told to not worry about, to not try to be like the nations, to not try to ingratiate ourselves to our earthly national surroundings, because those identities ultimately are unimportant and ephemeral, but we have treated them as though they have eternal significance.
One of your trips, which must have been a real difficult trip to make, found you overlooking some cool river in France with a bunch of theologians. And I paused for a moment of prayer when I read that, because I knew how you suffered on that particular trip. but it did seem like, because you mentioned that someone from the Wall Street Journal was there. I don't remember her name, but I do remember you mentioning that she was there and asked a question. So it seems like that there were either some reporters at this thing or some writers at this thing. Kind of explain what was that gathering, and then what were some of the high points that you took away from it?
Yeah, it was first of all, you're right to tease me about that. Although I will say that given some of the dark places I had to go in reporting this book, I feel like a trip to the French Riviera was deserved. But yeah, it was a real hardship assignment. I joined a group of probably 15 or so others, academics and journalists mostly, at this conference in France. This was in the fall of 2022. And really, one of the big thematic topics that we were discussing and trying to tackle was Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so there were two brilliant speakers with us, two theologians that day. One is a man named Miroslav Volf, who's a theologian at Yale. And he grew up in the former Yugoslavia and left just before all of the terrible ethnic cleansing and civil war broke out in the region. And he was joined by a man named Cyril Hovarun. And Cyril is a Russian Orthodox dissident. He is a Ukrainian by birth, but worked in the Russian Orthodox Church. And in fact, he was the kind of theological aide-de-camp to Patriarch Kirill, who is the second most powerful man in Russia, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. And this whole seminar session that we had with these two gentlemen was so incredibly interesting and scary in ways, because they were talking about the ways in which identitarian thinking merges with religious justification for mass violence and for conflict, and how some of the great tragedies, some of the great crimes in world history have been carried out at that intersection of sort of tribal identitarian affiliation and religious justification. And they were talking about that in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, of course, a land war in Europe that was happening just 1,000 miles from where we were in France. But they were also doing a lot of winking and nodding at us and talking not so implicitly about the justification complex that's underway and very visible in the United States. And specifically, one of them was talking at a certain point about this idea of civil religion and how Trumpism has begun to, in many ways, resemble what the historical blueprint of a civil religion might look like. And that was really a provocative conversation that I felt like many American Christians would be totally oblivious to, because I was oblivious to it. And I walked away from that really feeling at least encouraged that it was being diagnosed and that we were talking about it very clearly, but also a little bit startled, because it seemed to me that we could be in danger here of something that we don't even realize we're in danger of.
Is this the chapter that drew the parallel or the distinction, I guess, between civil religion and political religion?
Yeah, that's right.
So I've used the phrase civil religion to refer to what I also call the God of the Grammys, just the generic God that's out there that everybody thinks they're a Christian because of that. But the distinction made between civil and political religion was kind of a new thought process for me. So break that down a little bit, because I think that'll help everyone who's listening kind of get their mind around how these two terms can help explain the present moment.
Yeah, of course. Marty, give me 2 seconds. I've got the PDF in front of me. I want to Google it to make sure that I don't.
It's in a book you wrote. It's called The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory.
Listen, you're dealing with a guy who hasn't slept more than 5 hours a night in about 6 months. So my brain is like falling out of my head at this point.
I want to tell everybody too that one of the really good things about this book is that it's like there are chapters in the book that actually refer to things that happened in 2023. So this is not like something you worked on for 3 years and finished 3 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
You worked on it for 3 years and finished it 6 months ago and then rushed it to press somehow or another.
I wanted, you know, and part of the reason I wanted to pull up the PDF because I want to quote this one theologian, the dissident now who has left. He's left the Russian Orthodox Church and he's traveling around Europe preaching this at great personal risk to himself, right? And his name's Cyril Hoveron. And here's what he says to us in France. He says, basically, he's drawing this distinction between political religion and civil religion. And he says, you know, political religion is really imposed by the state, whereas civil religion is practiced voluntarily. And you know, a civil religion can have some sort of quasi-religious rituals that are optional for people, but it becomes very attractive and it's about identity. But then that can morph into a political religion. And this is what he says. He says, you know, a political religion has the power of imposition upon the Russian people. And he says, in Trumpism, talking about in the United States context, in Trumpism, we are still dealing with a civil religion, at least a form of civil religion. It is not yet a political religion. But he says, I still believe it is possible. And that was, I think, what was really striking is essentially inherent to that distinction between civil religion and political religion is this idea that civil religion is it can be dangerous, it can spook us a little bit, but ultimately it can also be harmless. It can be something that kind of comes and goes. But it's really almost the difference between like a tornado watch and a tornado warning. Mm-hmm. That when civil religion starts to really spiral fully into political religion, what follows historically is mass violence, mass death, mass displacement, and I think the cherry on top, enormous damage done to the religion itself, right? If you think about, you know, if you think about Nazism and the Twisted Cross, I mean, it took decades and decades of work from European theologians to try to undo the damage done to the message of Christ in Europe. And in many ways, that damage has never been undone. I mean, secularism in Europe, I think in the eyes of many people who have studied it, is has been in decline for, you know, nearly 100 years now, in large part because of the weaponization of Christianity for identitarian means that we saw in the first half of the 20th century. And so that is the risk, I think, that we start to deal with here in the American context.
That's the very thing that I've tried to convince anybody who I get into conversation with, is the real danger behind Christian nationalism is that it will morph into some type of persecution, because that's what always happens to those things. And there will be a purifying, and some of these guys are pretty obvious about it. You know, if you break laws on the Sabbath, or if you break blasphemy laws or something like that, if they get in charge, then there's going to be the death penalty. So there's no reason, semi-jokingly tell people sometimes, the reason I'm not a Christian nationalist is because I've been to church conferences. It's guaranteed to be a disaster if it goes in that direction. So I'm glad to see that you're addressing that in the book as well, and that political civil angle can help define some of that. I do want to go into one of the darker parts of your book when you visited my next door neighbor. I've read, counting your interview with Greg Locke, my friend Bob Smetana has also interviewed Greg Locke. And I watched, I think it was an NBC interview with Greg Locke, which is a video part of a news broadcast. And the thing that every person, and you mentioned this in your book, the thing that every reporter who has talked to him that I've watched has said, gosh, he's just so soft-spoken and he's so quiet and he's just so normal when you're talking to him. And I think he's got two acts. I think he has an act for the press and I think he has an act for the people. And that whatever his motivation is between those acts, I have my own thoughts. But talk about why you chose to go visit an unhinged tent preacher and get some interviews about what he was thinking, Mr. QAnon.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said earlier, it was important to me to cast this net as wide as I could. And, you know, Greg Locke is a guy who, and I write this in the book, Marty, you know, 15, 20 years ago, Greg Locke would have been treated like a cult figure. Yep. I mean, he would have gotten the Westboro Baptist treatment. We would not have thought of him as anybody with, you know, any serious influence, not somebody that we should even bother paying attention to. But, you know, this is a phenomenon of the social media era, certainly. And it's also a phenomenon of the kind of populist uprising in our politics where, you know, Greg Locke now has a couple million followers on social media who he preaches to, and he gets invited to the White House and he's taking pictures there with Franklin Graham. And suddenly this is not somebody that you can just dismiss as a sort of some fringe cult figure. He is in the room where it happens, right? And he's a guy who speaks for some not insignificant slice of the American Christian community. You're right about putting on the act. I mean, what I found to be most striking about Greg Locke was how he was constantly toggling back and forth between feeling like, oh, he just said something that was going to make him sound crazy, so he has to walk it back. And then, oh, he just said something that was going to make him sound soft and weak, and now he has to kind of double down on the crazy. So he was almost playing this game with himself where you know, you mentioned like QAnon. I actually think the biggest surprise to me was I actually think that if I had to, you know, I'm not equipped as a psychologist or therapist or anything to make this judgment call, but I read people for a living and I have a pretty good sense of usually who I'm dealing with. And I actually think that Greg Locke, much more so than most of the people in his congregation, the people in his orbit, the people at these conferences that he'll go to that are just totally unhinged, I actually think that Greg Locke gets it to a large extent. I think he's in on the joke. I think he, you know, I don't think he wants anything to do in his heart of hearts with QAnon. I don't think he believes in Christian national. In fact, he told me that. He said, you know, Christian national doesn't even make sense. That's a contradiction in terms, right? But then like 2 weeks later, he's out at some event calling himself a proud Christian national. So which is it? You know, which is it? And I think in many ways, what the Greg Locke experience for me represented was a window into the incentive structures that exist. And, you know, if you're Greg Locke, who has gone from preaching to 75 people on a Sunday morning to suddenly preaching to, you know, 7,000 people at these various events and getting, you know, millions of followers and raising tons of money, tons and tons and tons of money. I mean, we can't overstate the effect that the financials have in all of this. You know, he looks around and even though he thinks that it's overkill, or he thinks it's hyperbole, or he thinks it's just downright gross and cynical and anti-biblical, all the incentives are pushing him back in that direction. And it's just sad at the end of the day. I mean, we talk about it in terms of how crazy some of it is and how loathsome and corrupted some of it is, but it's also, it's just sad because I think deep down, this is a guy who I think wants to preach the gospel, but knows that he's almost backed himself into a place where he can't, or he can't preach the pure version of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So your book is The Kingdom, the Power and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. As we wind up, is evangelicalism in the American context going to last, or has it seen its moment in the sun?
Boy, I don't know. I will say this, Marty. One of the real bright spots for me in this whole journey has been spending a lot of time with young believers, you know, especially on college campuses, even at places, you know, it's funny, like to a lot of folks, myself included, Liberty University has become almost an avatar of the corruption and the compromises made and the ends justify the means mentality, the sort of weaponizing of spirituality. But even in that setting, when you spend time with the students at Liberty, you can't walk away from it not feeling good about some of the generational turnover that's taking place here. I talk in one part of the book, I talk about the children of the moral majority. That's a phrase I use. And I consider myself one of those children, by the way. I mean, that was my family's whole background, right? But, you know, whereas the moral majority generation really seems to process a lot of these threats to Christianity as external, right? It was big government. It was the secularists. It was, you know, they're coming after us. The barbarians are at the gates. They're going to persecute us. They're going to shut down our churches, which, by the way, is why, you know, what made COVID-19 such an inflection point in so many of these congregations. Young people process this very differently. They tend to think about the trouble in Christianity from the inside out. They tend to internalize a lot of this, and they want to know, you know, what's gone wrong within the church? What's gone wrong in our faith tradition? How do we fix it? How do we hold ourselves accountable? How do we do better? And part of that, I've noticed, to answer your question, is a real rethinking of our labels, of our identities beyond just being followers of Jesus. Like, it's really interesting that even a guy like Russell Moore, he says to me in the book that, look, you know, being a Southern Baptist started to become a distraction from being a Christian, right? And I think that for a lot of people, myself included, being an evangelical started to be almost a distraction from being a Christian. And that is the thing you hear from a lot of young people, including very conservative ones, theologically, culturally, politically. You know, these are people who almost to a T would fit with the kind of tradition of evangelicalism that we've known in this country. And they want nothing to do with it. They feel like it has become a barrier to entry, that it's become an albatross around their neck as they try to share the gospel with their neighbors and with their classmates and their peers. And so in that sense, if you just think about it almost demographically speaking, you have to wonder how sustainable the evangelical label is. Because from everything I've seen, there's not a lot of affection for it in this next generation.
Well, thanks for listening to this special episode of Uncommentary. My guest, Tim Alberta. You really do need to pick up his book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Is it available yet?
Marty, it comes out December 5th. Okay. And it'll be sold, you know, all kinds of booksellers, local booksellers, but also on Amazon, all the ordinary places that you can find it.
Excellent. Tim, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Marty.
As always, thank you for listening to Uncommentary. If you'd like to keep up with me on Twitter, it's at Marty Duran. If you'd like to follow the podcast account, it's at Uncommentary Pod. Please rate and review, and whichever podcatcher you listen to, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Google Play or Podbean or Overcast or CastBox, whichever one you use, if you can rate and review, then that would be awesome. It just helps with search results and gives some credibility to the podcast itself. And as you have an opportunity, if you would promote it, whether you put the link from uncommentarypodcast.com on your Facebook page, or if you tweet the link or retweet the initial broadcast that it's live, anything like that to help spread the word is always appreciated. And as always, Sola Deo Gloria. This is Marty Duran for Uncommentary Podcast.